Record Collections and Recollections. Out of the Box with Mia Hull on FBI Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to FBI Radio 94.5. I'm Mia Hull and this is Out of the Box. Every Thursday from 12 to 1, I sit down with one person and their record collection and pore over some of the stories and songs from their life. We're broadcasting from the FBI studio in Redfern today, which means we're coming to you from unceded land belonging to the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I want to take this moment to pay my respects to Gadigal elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to any First Nations person listening right now. Gadigal people have been sharing stories and songs on this land since the beginning of time. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. The first time I learned about today's guest was during all of the confusion around Australia's vaccine rollout last year. Mandy, the owner of Secrets of Africa, was speaking out in defence of her son's vaccination status following news St. Joseph's Eotwolves had received the sought-after COVID-19 vaccine. Eloise Eftos is the actress behind Mandy and Australia's first attractive comedian. Today we're going to look at her life and her dreams and her career and the songs that have soundtracked the big moments. Eloise, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me, Mia. It's so nice to be seeing you in person and be here in a studio. It's so professional. I'm loving it. Thank you for having me at FBI.
She says so professional as she's looking into a mic covered by a tissue.
That's the professional stuff I'm talking about. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about, Mia. I'm going, wow, you guys really pulled out all the stops for me.
Yeah.
And the fact that Mia's drinking a tea from a cup that says hot stuff, I was going, everyone's on theme. I'm like, this is the treatment I was hoping
it's
the
red carpet.
It is. It literally
is. We rolled it out just for you. But before you were at this stage in your life where you had radio stations rolling out a red carpet for you, I want to go back to the very beginning, Eloise.
Yes.
Did you have an interest in acting or drama when you were little?
Look, I guess I've always been like a little performer. And I think when I was really young, there would be times when, you know, my parents or family members or, you know, we'd have family friends over and, yeah, I'd sell tickets to the family and make them sit down and watch me perform and, you know, put everybody into positions and direct them and stuff. So, yeah, it was sort of part of, I guess, my childhood was just being a performer. I think I always knew that I was going to be in that realm at some stage. That sounds so silly, but I just don't know what else I would do because that's sort of what I did when I was young. Like, that's just what I did. My mum enrolled me into ballet when I was probably about 3 or 4. And then I guess from there, then I started singing when I was about 8. And, I guess acting was sort of just part of it. But, yeah, it definitely started from, like, about 3 or 4 when I was dancing and singing. And sort of I would be in the car with my mum listening to, you know, Tina Arena. I remember she had this tape and it had a cassette. And vividly remember so well, Tina Arena was on their chains and the Fugees Killing Me Softly. And I can't – a Seal, like, Kiss from a Rose. And I would be – belting it out at like probably 6 years old and was like, I don't know whether it was to be a singer or a dancer. I just knew I think I wanted to be on stage or I just enjoyed, you know, like being, I guess, performing or doing those particular things. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's not even an option to do anything else.
Yeah. It was a bit like that. It was almost like, I don't know. Yeah. It's funny because a lot of people I think that are in the arts sort of say that and it's sort of crazy that, I think you kind of know when you're young with a lot of things, but people kind of society and all of these things, I'm sure if you talk to people from different backgrounds and everything that, you know, that deep down, you know who you are or what you want to do.
Well, I can say from hosting this show that most people who've gone on to work in the arts talk about performing for their family as little kids as well.
And being like a little brat and everyone's like, we don't care. And you're like, yes, you do, because
you've
guess
got all
what?
The cousins
one
on
day
it.
It's going to cost $150 to see me and you're getting a little piece of paper that says plus one or something on it. You know what I mean? Like, and yeah, it's so funny how we would – yeah, that was just part of my childhood, was just doing that.
Apart from playing Tina Arena in the car, what did your family do to foster your love of music and performing?
So I think my parents are both, like, they're not in the arts themselves, but they love the arts and they love the theatre, they love movies, they love actual visual art and fashion and things. And it was amazing how much they sort of influenced, like, me and my sisters. I'm the eldest of 3 girls and we all – are now working in the arts in some capacity. And I think it was really fostered from when we were kids, influenced a lot by music. Like, I just remember the music was always quite eclectic in our house. And even, you know, we'd go to the local record store near where my dad still works, to, in Perth, in Leederville. It's called Urban Records. And I think it was called that back then. But he would just go and like find CDs. And I think I was kind of more attracted to the covers of the CDs, but it was amazing how much was like really out there kind of music that wasn't.
What kind of covers attracted you?
Like, I think, you know what was so funny? This is going to probably, people are going to probably go, what the hell? But I remember like one of them was like this gorgeous woman, and it was like, she was in like a silk, black silk bed sheet. And it was a, it was called After the Playboy Mansion. And it was, Dimitri from Paris and his sort of like electronic music and sounds and stuff, and just like DJ mixes of this really cool funk and soul music. But I remember being like, oh, that's like a beautiful cover. And just sort of, and I remember seeing like another one that was Playboy at the record store, and I was quite young, and I said to my dad, like, look, Dad, that's like the same, like the, and I remember like this woman saw me say that and think she was a bit like in shock, because I didn't know what Playboy was. Yeah. Like, I didn't know, but it's funny, like those kind of covers, and just like, I guess thinking back, like, you know, even the ones with Dionne Warwick on it with her beautiful face on them, and my dad had all this like really cool taste in music that I think people would be like, whoa, like your dad was into that. But yeah, he was, and that kind of, those covers are really out there. And I think I was kind of attracted to that. And then when I listened to the music, like I remember having a Walkman and stealing all those CDs and taking them as if they were mine. And it was like all these like kind of chill out albums, my Ministry of Sound and like probably, yeah, George Michael and yeah, all of those. And it was amazing because like my parents are 9 years apart. And that also changed the dynamic of what music they were into.
And had your parents grown up in Australia as well?
Yeah, they were born in Australia, but both of them are first generation. So, yeah, both of their parents. Actually, my mum's dad was born in Australia, but Macedonian background. Mm. But my, yeah, other grandparents all grew up, yeah, over in Greece and Macedonia, or, you know, that gets complicated. But, yeah, wherever they – and they all immigrated, yeah, to Australia.
And what did that mean for you growing up with first-generation Greek and Macedonian parents?
It was interesting. I guess there's, like, this whole – I especially, like, trying to do something in the arts and trying to be in that world. Like, it sort of interesting because not many people – I didn't know any people that sort of did what I wanted to do. Especially in my family, that sort of was a bit, you know, and I guess back then I sort of did, you know, do all these extracurricular activities where I was singing and dancing and acting and I don't know, it just sort of, it still was, oh, you probably have to graduate and go to uni, or, you know, graduate high school, go to uni, get a degree, and then maybe you can do whatever you want sort of thing. But it wasn't completely forced on me. It was just sort of this unwritten kind of rule. I guess when I say rule, it wasn't like, you know, but you wanted to do the right thing and that kind of stuff. But I also look at especially my grandfather on my dad's side, my dad or Vic, he was such a performer and you know, very funny and loved to dance. He was always doing the Greek dancing at the clubs and stuff. And you know, he was very much like, I want to see in Hollywood, you know. But even as a young girl who was of, you know, WOG, you know, ethnic background, I was so obsessed with like the Spice Girls. That was my, how could I forget to mention the Spice Girls? I was so obsessed with the Spice Girls, but I wanted to be Baby. I thought that to be attractive, to be wanted to be whatever, you had to be blonde. Like that was such a thing. And I guess, you know, you had Britney, Christina, like all these amazing blonde pop stars. And I just remember being, and I guess my mum's blonde as well, even though she's still a WOG, she's got fair hair. And I just remember being like, oh, I've got to be blonde and that kind of thing. And that kind of like made me feel a bit, not like an outsider, but don't think I really ever felt like I was pretty enough and that kind of thing when I was growing up. And I remember my dad sort of saying, no, like, you know, when you grow up, like, you know, there's something beautiful about, like, you know, your features and stuff like that. And I know that I'm, you know, we're white, but it was just like really funny how it still kind of like affected me to not be like, you know, this Aryan looking girl. Yeah. So how funny. Even just thinking of that and the way that, like, I guess pop music was at that time as well, and what pop stars looked like. And it was interesting growing up as a girl from an ethnic background, I guess. It feels funny to say it, but but at the time, that's how I felt. It was crazy. Yeah.
Eloise Eftos, you are the perfect guest for this show. It never ceases to amaze me how much our music becomes a part of our memories.
Totally.
And all the way up until 1 o'clock today, we will keep looking at the songs that have meant something special to you throughout your life. And in reflecting on your early life, you did mention Dionne Warwick a couple of times.
Yeah, I did.
I reckon we should play Dionne
You reckon
Warwick.
Dionne? Yeah, no, for sure. I'm like trying to toss up between like Mascanada, Sergio Mendes, because I'm like, I love the world music, but then also Walk On By, Dionne Warwick. I think that singing her songs at home definitely did make me feel like, yeah, like I wanted to be a singer. Like her music was so beautiful and inspiring, and her voice, you know. So yeah, let's go for it.
Perfect. This is Walk On by Dionne Warwick. You're listening to FBI Radio 94.5 on Out of the Box with me, Mia Hull, and Australia's first attractive comedian, Eloise Eftos. Walk on by.
Broken and blue, walk on by, walk on by. Foolish pride, that's all that I have left, so let me.
You're listening to FBI Radio 94.5 DAB, or if you're streaming via the podcast or on the website, that song was chosen by Eloise Eftos, my guest on Out of the Box today. It was called Walk On by Dionne Warwick. Eloise, we were just talking about your early life and this hunger that you had for acting and performance. So what was the next step for you when you finished school?
Yeah, so when I finished high school, I guess, like, I did drama and, you know, as a TE subject, and I did media as well, and I didn't do music or dance, but I guess it was me sort of going, can't do all art. You know, you kind of get pushed towards not doing all artsy things.
Do you think that maybe speaks to what you were talking about before with almost the migrant experience and those expectations?
A little bit. And it was kind of like, I remember thinking, like, I wish I could just do all artsy things, but I remember my dad sort of saying, well, just make sure you do maths, because there's always an answer with maths. It was sort of like, at least you know that you'll be right. But I'm so bad at it. It was like the most stressful thing. Anyway, I finished high school, and I remember being really upset. My parents never said that I shouldn't audition for WAPA. They never said no. They never said don't do it. But it was funny how, like, I felt this weird feeling of like, oh, I shouldn't do it. I should just go. And I didn't even really know what I wanted to do at uni, to be honest. I just knew that it's hard. It's hard to finish high school at 17 and be like, okay, well, good luck. Like, what? I can't believe that people knew what they, I honestly don't think anyone really knows what they want to do at 17, let's be honest. If the thing is, I probably did know what I wanted to do, but I suppressed that because I didn't think it was the right thing, you know? And so I ended up going to uni first straight out of high school and studying screen arts and journalism at Curtin University in Perth. And I think for my family, it was a little bit like, yeah, this is a bit more realistic than probably what I hadn't really spoken about, but there was that underlying, you know, kind of, oh, she's going to want to do that. But even while I was there, I guess I was still in my head going, oh, I sing, dance and act, so I probably should do musical theatre. So that was in my head. I was like, I'm probably going to go to WAPA and do musical theatre. And WAPA in Perth is like such a big deal because it's such a prestigious school and, you know, the alumni is, you know, incredible and all of that. And it's like right there in arm's reach.
Well, it's a big deal here in Sydney.
It is.
As well.
I was going to say, people in Sydney know about it. It's like a big deal in Australia. It's like a incredible achievement to go there. I still was doing my degree, but like I finished and it was good, but I knew that I didn't really want to be, like, I learned so much. And I'm looking back now, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad that I did that, those 3 years.
I was going to ask if you were happy with that choice.
You know what? At first I was like, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
But I think looking back, I'm like, that was some of the best education that I got, because now as I am working as an actor, I know how the film sets work. I know, even with, I've done a few live crosses and like interviews and things, and like I know what's happening a little bit more. Like I've seen that side, and I feel like I would suggest to anyone trying to do acting or comedy that they should try and, I don't know, learn a little bit about this side of the of the, yeah, like of what we do, because that it's, it gives you a bit of empathy with the people that you're working with, gives you a bit of knowledge so that you're not just going in, you know, that's the thing. You don't go in cold turkey going, oh, where do I stand? Like, what do I do? Who yells out first? Like, how do I know when to go? Like, all of that stuff, which sometimes, you know, obviously at acting school, you do learn that, but it's to another extreme when you're actually doing it. But yeah, I also, I kind of finished that degree and I think I was a little bit like, I still was so young. I still was like, look, I still want to audition and do something. And I think I just decided I was going to audition then. I thought I was ready to do I think I ended up getting into the musical theatre certificate course at WAPA, which is just like a 1 year. And it was really great. And I felt like I was, you know,
What was that shift in gears like?
Yeah, it was
interesting.
When,
you know, you were like, I have to get a real job, I have to do this.
Totally.
And then deciding that you would now pursue the arts.
Yeah.
What was that like for you and how did your family receive that?
Totally. It was interesting because it was kind of like, I think my family knew deep down, like luckily my parents are really supportive of me and my sisters and very much, you know, they always have that sort of mentality of like, well, you may as well give it a go, you know, because they could see... they could see that drive and they could see it's in me and it's sort of like, I don't think they want us to have any regrets. But anyway, so basically ended up doing the certificate course. While I was doing that, I also started singing in bands and it was just like any outlet I think I could get. I was dancing as well. I would do dance classes separately. I would do sort of dance hall, hip hop. Then I was singing in funk and soul bands with these guys that I sort of knew from high school days, and it was just me and four boys, and it was, yeah, funk and soul music. They decided on the name Eloise and the Infinite Squeeze, and we would play like, how cute, and we would play it like, yeah, the local, like one of the local pubs, like on Friday nights, and it taught me a lot and how hard the industry is. Like that was my first sort of intro to all of that. It also was like my first intro to sort of going back on stage. Didn't really get too much with the musical theatre at WAPA, like the cert course. It was more like with the boys, like playing in the band.
And let's leave things right here at your entry back to the stage.
Yeah.
I would love to play a song by Eloise and the Infinite Squeeze
right now. I was like, one of the covers, we used to do like a reggae version of Whole Little Love. And like when I say reggae, it was just like the style, you know, like it was very much, I'm trying to think of like what songs were probably the most popular one we played for these crowds.
If you think
crowds.
Of it after the show, I'll pop it in the programs page on fbiradio.com.
But
we have chosen a Lauryn Hill song to play.
Yes, yes. So for me, one of the songs, because I was also playing at a lot of, at Ellington Jazz Club, one of the local music venues in Perth. I remember organising just like my own night where it was just me and I got these incredible other artists and a band, and it was a tribute to all like the amazing women in hip hop and soul music. And yeah, one of the songs was Doo Wop, That Thing by Lauryn Hill. And God, it's such a great song. And that album is so incredible. So yeah, this is a good one to, yeah, kick that off. Thank you where you be in. Hair weaves like Europeans. Fake nails done by Koreans. Come again.
Do Wop, That Thing. It was Lauryn Hill on FBI Radio 94.5. You are listening to Out of the Box. I'm Mia Hull. I am joined by actor and comedian Eloise F. Toss, the chooser of that song. And where we left things off, Eloise, you were talking about making that choice to do the arts and, you know, getting back on stage after a stint of pursuing
totally.
A real job, quote unquote.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like from there, you move into this really big hustle.
And totally.
I feel like, and I'm putting words in your mouth, and I know that I am, but
no,
that hustle
okay.
kind of kicks off with a trip to New York.
Yes, totally. that was wild. So basically, oh God, yeah, I'm trying to, thank God you said that, because I was like, oh my gosh, I've skipped a bit ahead with that that gig that I did at the Ellington Jazz Club. That was after New York. But before that, I started to take things a little bit seriously. So I sort of auditioned for all the big schools after I did that course at WAPA, auditioned for the acting and musical theatre courses at WAPA, NIDA, VCA. And it was, God, it was a great audition run. Like, I got to the final round for most of, like, I think for all the courses, maybe except for, I'm trying to think of, no, it would have been final round. And I didn't get into any of them. And I was distraught. I was so devastated because I think it was just so close. And it felt like this is my ticket to get to the next stage. But looking back, I'm like, gosh, another 3 years of study. Like, I don't know if I could have done that. Would have been a lot. And so I ended up going, I'm not going to let that stop me. And I did like a few community theatre shows. I was still singing in the band. And then I ended up, got auditioning for Stella Adler Studio of Acting in New York City. My friend Ashley, one of my best friends, was studying there at the time. She was doing the 2 year, and I just auditioned for the summer course, which is about 3 months. And I was like, this is what I need to do, just get out of here a little bit, experience this city that I've always had this fascination with as well. Like, even my 21st was New York themed. I'd never been there. What was that about? Like, you know what I mean? Like, never been there, and I was dressed up as a Statue of Liberty. And I remember my dad doing this speech being like, you know, she represents, like, independence and all this kind of stuff. And I think I had this, like, weird, you know, like, obsession and fascination that I still have with New York City.
Did it fulfill your fantasy?
Oh, my gosh. So it fulfilled it more than I could have imagined. And it was crazy how, like, for me, it was not only just about being there and studying there and experiencing that this acting school, it was about being in New York City and experiencing the culture and the vibrant life of this, like, it's constantly pulsing and you just can't escape anything there. Like, it's like, when I say that, I mean, you know, you're constantly, your senses are constantly stimulated, and you're, you know, walking down the street and there's people playing music and there's people on the subway playing music, or, you know, then you can go see a Broadway show and you walk out and there's 50 million things happening. And it was incredible. I think did like a little short film thing when I was there, because I just would meet people, and it was just so exciting, so exhilarating. Mm. I even played, like, jammed with a few guys in Brooklyn, like, in one of their bands, and just that kind of stuff was constantly happening. And it kind of was like, this is what I need. Like, this city is incredible. I need to come back here. And then I went to Chicago, and I had met these actors on the TV show Chicago PD at the Boom Boom Room at the Standard in New York, which is sort of like, you can't get in unless you know someone. So funny. I don't even know how me and my friends got in that night. And I met these actors from Chicago PD, and they're like, let us know when you're in Chicago. We'll put you up in accommodation and, like, we'll take you to set. I ended up messaging them. And in Chicago, I think I also decided that I was going to stay for a little bit longer, because I was supposed to fly back maybe a few days after I was in Chicago. And I was like, I still need to say goodbye to New York. And even just being in Chicago, that city as well is just, like, incredible. And so much art, going to Second City, seeing improv and hanging out with these actors and being on set and just watching people on set and going, this is what I want to do. This is where I want to be. And, you know, they're taking me to baseball games and all that kind of stuff. So I was living this fantasy that I always wanted to experience. And I would always walk around. I think I was, you know, calling back home, trying to organize with the travel agent, like, can I please stay a bit longer in New York City? Is there a way to change my flight? And while I was in Chicago, I remember feeling quite anxious because I don't think I was ready to go home. And I would walk around, and I remember staying at this really, really cool place after I checked out of the hotel that the actors had booked for me. And it was called the Freehand Hotel in Chicago. I wonder if it's still there. It's more like a hostel hotel. So cool. And the music they would play was, like, amazing. Like, and I would Shazam the music, like, every day. Mm. And I'd be like, oh, this is such a sick song. This is so cool. And then I would walk around Chicago River? Is that what it is? And I would go for these, like, long, like, anxiety walks where I would just, like, strut to this music. And I also remember being, like, with these actors and some of their crew at, like, one of the local, dive bars, and one of them put on, like, Can't You Hear Me Knocking, the Rolling Stones. And that song reminds me of that trip.
That's perfect. Yeah. And I want to circle back to that in a couple of minutes. But I guess when you're talking about this stint of your life and it's this whirlwind where you're getting, you know, picked up by all of these different actors and making all of these relationships.
Yeah.
It's like this huge flurry. What does it feel like to then come back to Australia? What did your life look like when you came back?
Totally. It felt really, it felt kind of, it was depressing a little bit.
Yeah.
I remember crying the whole way home. And not because I didn't want to go back home and see my family. Like, of course I did. But I was like, it's hard to leave what an experience that was. And I am now, you know, hoping I can go back in the next year or so, because I do feel like it's the right time. Even if it is just a holiday or even just to do stand-up. I wasn't doing stand-up when I was there, but I was watching a lot of it. And that was really interesting how that kind of drove me as well, because I would watch these people doing stand-up in America and I was like, I've always had this like bucket list, like I'd love to do stand-up comedy.
Well, tell me about when you first did do stand-up.
So that was when I first did stand-up. Was back in Perth. So then when I got back, had a really low moment where I was like, I can't believe I'm back here. I do love Perth so much, but it was hard. It was hard. And I ended up that year after, I ended up getting into the screen course at Whopper. And that was sort of my chance to, I was like, you know what? I just need one little bit something more that I can, say that I've solidified that training. I feel like I haven't had enough screen experience. I've done one little course. Like, that was my chance to sort of go. And then after that, I'm moving. It was kind of one of those moments. And I don't want to study for 3 years. I think I've had enough study. Because I also think it's great if you do a 3 solid years. I also think there's other ways to, you know, build up your training. And I also was performing with a cabaret group as well at that time. Called the Showhouse Perth, and I was emceeing and singing and dancing in that show, and it was kind of burlesque cabaret. But that's when I started actually writing jokes, because I was the MC and I would write sort of material, and there was like an opening monologue where I'd sort of be like, you know, don't touch the girls, do this, do that, like, and I was writing jokes and people were laughing and I was like, oh. And then I kind of, while I was studying, writing a lot more, because we were sort of encouraged to write during this Whopper course, because it was screen and, you know, we're encouraged to sort of write our own material and stuff. And then I started to write in this sort of persona. And it was during the break of this Whopper course that I was like, you know what, I'm going to try and do 5 minutes at an open mic in Perth. And I had a comedian friend in Perth, sort of, I went over to his house and he was like, yeah, you've got 5 minutes, and helped me sort of confirmed that I had that. And I remember the girl that was booking it was like, oh, we don't usually do this, but there's not that many women in comedy in Perth. So it was sort of like, all right, like, we'll let you have a go. And I was the only girl on, and I guess I sort of had like my acting background, so that kind of helped as well. I knew all my jokes off by heart. I remember one of the comics was like, oh, where's your notepad? Like, and I was like, oh, I don't need it. Like, I know my lines, like, you know what I mean? And it went really well and it was amazing. And it was like, oh, wow, I finally ticked that off the bucket list. But I didn't think much more of it. And then I remember my now friend Wolfie, I didn't know him at the time, but he's a very funny comedian who lives in Perth now. But he was there for my first gig and he was like, you've got to keep doing this. And I remember him saying that to me and I was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, and I think my persona at the time was much more playing dumb and playing her down, not being as I really don't like doing self-deprecating humor. I think it's a bit like, I understand why other people do, but I think for me with the persona, I don't want to do that. And I think I made her a little bit, when I first wrote the joke, she was a bit pretty girl playing dumb kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of thought, oh, I don't, as time went on and the more gigs that I did, it wasn't that many when I was, you know, at Whopper, because I didn't really have the time, but I sort of was like, I don't want her to be dumb. Like, she can be smart and she can be, it's a very, very heightened version of me, but I was like, she can be hot and smart and funny and she doesn't have to sort of apologize for that or pretend to be dumb or pretend to be, you know, not in on the joke.
Yeah,
and I
sure.
kind of loved that, because I was quite inspired by, you know, Natasha Leggero, Amy Schumer, Chelsea Handler, like all these American comics, because I didn't see anyone in Australia doing that style of comedy. So yeah, and that's sort of how that happened.
Perfect. Yeah. And yeah, in a couple of minutes' time, I do want to dig more into the persona and the persona that you've arrived at now.
Yes.
And the Eloise Eftos we know when we go to see your comedy. But first,
yeah,
I want to go back to that moment that you painted so beautifully before about walking in Chicago and listening to Can't You Hear Me Knocking.
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to say about that song before we jump in?
Oh, look, I know that the Stones is probably a bit of controversy because, you know, it's very influenced by, you know, these incredible black artists and blues and you know, and soul and this 70s, and rock. But for me also, the Rolling Stones are one of my favorite bands from that era. And I think, yeah, that song gave me a bit of drive, and it was like that, you know, it meant something to me. And I ended up seeing them live in London, like a few years later. Actually, it would have been a year after, and it was incredible to sort of see them. And I don't even know if they played that song, but it didn't matter. It was sort of like, yeah, there's something about the Stones that always is, yeah.
Yeah.
Special to me. Yeah.
Well, that's okay. We can play the song right now on FBI Radio 94.5. Instead, it's called Can't You Hear Me Knocking by the Rolling Stones. Can't You Hear Me Knocking? It was the Rolling Stones on Out of the Box on FBI Radio 94.5, and it was chosen by Eloise Eftos, my guest on the show. Eloise, just before we played that song, you were talking about being in Perth and first starting in comedy. Mm. I think part of that shift to the new persona that you have, Australia's most attractive comedian, it almost coincides with your move to Sydney?
Yeah, it sort of did. So it was sort of like for me, I moved for acting. So it was, I finished the course. I ended up, graduating, going over to Sydney, and we did a screening because it was a screen course. We did a screening of all of our showreels, and some agents came to watch, and I ended up signing with someone. And then I was like, this is my ticket to go. Like, this is my purpose. I think I just wanted a little bit of something to give me a, yes, you're going to Sydney and this is why kind of thing. But before I left, I also performed at Perth Fringe. I did like the Showhouse Perth show, and I ended up writing a bit of that show as well. And I played like the devil, and it was called The Seven Deadly Sinners. It was really fun. So I got to work that kind of comedy acting muscle. And then I did Raw Comedy, and I ended up getting to the final, state final, for WA. Didn't win, but I also was like, didn't really expect it. I think I remember the guy who runs it, runs the venue, was like, oh, you came third, like, just so you know. And I was like, I don't really care about third. I care about winning. No, I'm just kidding. But it was more just like, there was that little bit of, I know that I did well for someone that hadn't really been on the scene for very long. And that made me feel really great. And being like, oh, great, you know, I'm doing something that I always wanted to do. And I ticked it off the list, you know.
Well, I feel like when I hear people talk about their come up in comedy, they have to do all these regional shows and really, you know, deal with some shitty crowds
before
they're doing things like Raw Comedy. It sounds like you jumped
And it kind of was like, I guess because I was doing something different, people were like, oh, you know, which was exciting. And that was fun. Also, that there were some people in the crowd that didn't get it, and I kind of loved that at the same time. It was hard, but I kind of loved it as well. And then when I went over to Sydney, I was obviously focusing more on acting, but I'd still do a few little open mics and things like that. And then I realized after doing Raw comedy in New South Wales in 2019, I did well again. I got to the state final again. Didn't win, but that was okay, because after that, all these like gates opened, because people saw me at that and then wanted me to come and perform at, you know, their venues, or told me, you know, then I'm meeting more people in the scene here. And I guess acting and comedy can be quite clicky, so it's hard to sort of immediately just like jump into it. You've got to you know, find your way. And then I started to kind of hustle at comedy a bit more, and then COVID hit. So then it was also, that was just before COVID hit, that was when we also did the first Mystery Flight. So for those that have seen it, and sort of, I got asked to host Cafe Lounge. At Cafe Lounge, there was a late night sun. It wasn't late night, but it was a, sorry, Sunday night, like a Saturday Night Live kind of vibe they wanted. And they wanted people to host every, it's more like a talk show kind of thing. And I remember having Ruby over at my house because they were like, who do you want to co-host? I was like, oh, Ruby, we were in a, we met doing a musical together called, it was a fringe show called Inner West Side, the musical. And then I sort of said, look, like we're hostesses. Why don't we be hostesses and be flight attendants, right? And I was like, we can dress up as flight attendants. It's themed. But then the guests that we had on, because that was already kind of cast, we can make them, some of them were actors and comedians. And we're like, oh, when the stand-up part's on, we'll go to New York. And when the our friend, you know, can play a character from a different country and that kind of thing. And that kind of birthed that. And I remember as well, it was just before just as COVID was starting, but it wasn't what it was. And I remember we closed the show and it went really well and it was like so much fun. And everyone was like, wow, this would be, you know, great if you could do this every month. And we're like, yeah, we will be. And I remember closing the show, we both said, and remember, coronavirus doesn't mean that you can be a racist. That's what we said at the end. That's how early on it was.
Foreboding. And in a couple of minutes' time, I do want to circle back to what COVID-19 meant for your comedy career.
Yes.
Just before, when you were talking about those first couple of Raw sets, you said people didn't get it.
Yeah.
I want to dig into that
totally,
and what there was for them not to get, because you are referring to the persona.
Yeah.
For someone who might not have seen you do comedy before, what is that persona?
So I sort of play, it's hard, I try to explain it like the best way possible. Like it is a very heightened version of me and my sense of humor. But the idea is, imagine sort of the popular girl in high school probably deciding to do stand-up comedy, or like, you know, like Regina George, for example, but probably not as mean, but getting up and deciding to do, it's like the popular girl in high school that maybe you liked, but you hated as well. Getting up and going, I'm way too good to be doing this and way too pretty, but I'm actually really good at it. Like that's sort of what I'm fluffing my words because I think I'm trying so hard for people that don't know what I do or how I do it to explain it in the nicest way possible. But I think as well, for me, I've had some people say that it's anti-feminist and that kind of thing. But my whole shtick is that it is for women, and I never make fun of women in my set. I do challenge some women and what they think. But I think that's also part of feminism, is that we shouldn't all just automatically be on each other's side. Like we have to, you know, work together and find what isn't working for all women. I think sometimes feminism, especially in comedy, can be very white feminism. And I think that for me, with my persona, it is not hurting anybody. It is making fun of, I guess, it's quite tongue-in-cheek. It's making fun of men and the way that men treat women and also the way society treats women. And it's so telling because every time I come out on stage in what I'm wearing, which is what I wear day to day, even that shocks the audience. Is like, that's not what comedians or female comedians should wear, which is bullshit to me. I don't think that that is okay at all. And I kind of hate that it's like that. And I find it funny even sometimes when I come off stage, there'll be women in the crowd and men that will say, oh, I know a girl just like you, or and stuff like that. Or
what does that mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I think that they're meaning, that, oh, there's a girl that's like you, that thinks she's all that kind of thing. And I'm sort of like, what's wrong with women thinking that they're, or being confident and not putting themselves down? Like, what's wrong with that? And I think it's quite shocking for people, because especially I think in comedy, I don't have any judgment the people that do self-deprecating humor. But for me, I try really hard not to, because I find it's not lending anything to the persona. But also in general, I'm like, listening to Nanette and watching Nanette, Hannah Gatsby put it so well, you know, am I making fun of myself for the benefit of other people to laugh at me? That kind of idea of, you know, I'm making fun of myself so that other people like will laugh at me. Whereas like if I make fun of other people and say that I'm really hot and all of that, people kind of go, wait, well, you can't say that. Especially in Australia, like tall poppy syndrome is rife. And I love challenging that. And that's sort of what it became. It became me trying to challenge that very old school Aussie mentality of you've got to pretend that you don't think you're good at what you do, downplay everything. Yeah. And I think it's so frustrating that we do that in Australia. And I love that I'm trying to challenge that. It can be really hard sometimes when crowds don't get it. And you can see them in the audience being quite like, you know, but I love it when people do get it, especially women, because it's for women. It's for women to sort of go, yeah, I can talk like that. And I love that sense of humor of sort of being like, yeah, like I'm really good at this. I feel like it's not even funny to sort of say that. It's more funny that I make fun of the world of comedy and the way that even the men in comedy are and how they see women. And yeah, it's, gosh, I could go on about it for ages, but yeah, I hope I'm making sense.
So interesting that we've kind of fallen into this big abstract discussion around feminism just on the basis of you having the title Australia's First Attractive Comedian, because nowhere in that does it say that it's about women.
Yeah, right. You've never said women. And that's what's so funny, Mia, is that it's like when I first put that on my bio, so that was during COVID, which I don't know if that's jumping around too much.
No, but that's okay.
Basically, I made a video about the security guard incident in Melbourne, and I pedestrian found the video. It went a little bit viral, not as viral as my AFL dancer one, but it did get a bit of traction. But I didn't have whether I was a comedian or actor in my bio, because I think I always was like, oh, that's a bit naff, like you don't want to tell people what you do. But after COVID, like I was going to say, like that's your resume now, this is how it is, you need to tell people what you do so that they can I guess address it accordingly, or just, you know, give you credit accordingly. Because I remember when they wrote the article, they said someone has made a parody or porn parody. It wasn't really a porn parody, but that freaked me out a bit. I remember when they wrote that article, but they basically said, you know, someone, and I was like, someone, like I'm an actor and I do comedy, like I'm a comedian. And then as a joke, I thought it was funny to call myself Australia's First Attractive Comedian because it tied in with the persona. I never said female, and that copped me a lot of shit. I remember when my AFL video went viral, that's how that became, I guess, obviously there's more people watching your content. And then I remember someone saying, like, that's really putting women down and stuff like that. And I was like, I never said that. And I remember just posting that on my story, just sort of to let other people know, like, that's not what this act is about. Also, you're watching comedy. It's obviously, everything's tongue in cheek. It's a joke. I'm not actually standing on stage saying like all the male comedians don't deserve to make it in comedy. Like there's some that probably don't, but also like, that's not my fault. Like that I'm speaking the truth. Like I think as well, people watch me on stage and it's like, they forget they're at a comedy show. Mm. Like I'm trying to make you laugh with how I'm saying things. And that's why there's so many layers to it. And I wish it's funny. It is like a social experiment every time I come out on stage.
So even the way that we're talking about it right now, like it sounds really funny to me, but then it's also sounds like you're almost reflecting society back on us.
Right. That's what's crazy. And that's what's so, even I'm going, what? Like I didn't even think that was my intention when I first did it. And it's crazy how it's become that.
I could talk about this with you.
I know,
hours.
I'm going, babe, how long is this interview going to be? Your poor listeners are going, we're over it. Sorry,
babe. Yeah, we do only have an hour, so I'm going to jump into a song now. And then after that, I do want to get into the personas that have come from COVID and the AFL video that you did just touch on.
Totally.
You've chosen a song by Edwin Collins to play on the show.
Yes. So this song, Edwin Collins, got that very, pretty sure it came out in the 90s, like 96, I think, but it's very 60s. Sort of mod vibe, which is some of my favorite music of all time. And this song, it's so perfect for the persona. I definitely love to walk out to it. If any booker is like, what song do you want to walk out to? I feel like this song is so perfectly matched to the persona, and it's amazing to strut to. So
perfect. It's called A Girl Like You. It's by Edwin Collins, and you're hearing it right here on FBI Radio 94.5. And I never known a girl like you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Out of the Box on FBI Radio 94.5. That song was by Edwin Collins. It was called A Girl Like You. My name is Mia Hull. I'm joined by Eloise Eftos, actor and comic, who chose that song. And just before we played it, we were talking about your persona, Eloise, and
yes,
what it is like for you to be on stage. Obviously, that changed in 2020 when COVID hit.
Totally,
yes. Walk me through that.
So I think when COVID hit, it was stressful. I remember packing up all my stuff. My lease was about to end at my place in Newtown. Packed up everything in 48 hours and just went back to Perth because so scared about the borders closing, so scared about what was going to happen. My auditions and gigs were cancelled. I was working retail at the time. I knew that was going to be closing down as well. So, I just got out of Sydney, and to be honest, going back to Perth was probably the best thing I could have done. But then I guess the way that doing comedy or like keeping occupied or, you know, all of that changed, and it was a hard time, and I think we're still feeling the repercussions of it, but it also elevated my career in a different way as well, which is crazy. I did not expect that, but I guess it was also my film degree came into it, my editing and video making, and then my acting, and then my comedy, and it all came in, and it was sort of me posting silly videos, and I started to post a lot more of that and sort of give people an insight into my repertoire, which sounds so silly, but that's what it was. It was like me going, oh, I'm rewatching The Sopranos, so I'll make a little parody video being Adriana in The Sopranos talking to Christopher about buying her a DVD player, and there's, you know, nobody has DVD players anymore. Like things like that.
Yeah.
And it was, everybody had to watch because nobody was doing anything else.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I had a few clips that I would post on my stand-up, or then I started to play like silly characters and, you know, making videos of the security guard situation. And it was my way to make like a comment on these like silly situations, like the government was fucking up and people were breaking the rules and doing stupid things. And then the big one that kind of broke me into another realm was making fun of the AFL not wanting to pay the grand final dancers. And that really grinded my gears, I think, because as a dancer, as a performer in the arts, gosh, it's happened so often where we get told that we're going to have to do work for free. And it pissed me off. And I was like, this is ridiculous, especially the AFL. I'm not an AFL girl myself. I dated an AFL player. Like that was my first boyfriend, was an AFL player. And I wasn't into the world. I didn't get it. I met a lot of the people, and I kind of look back at it now and I was like, ugh. Like that was not what I was into. I'm much more a soccer girl myself, very woggy of me. But it was so, what was so funny though, Mia, was that I was like, this is one of the biggest corporations in the country, and we've just gone through one of the worst hits to the economy. And I guess, you know, but they haven't suffered. They're allowed to fly all over the country and play the games and still be on TV. Whereas us artists are struggling, especially dancers. That's what pissed me off a lot too, which is we're so skilled. It takes years and so much time and money to, you know, get to a level where you can be professional. And I was like, fuck this. And I ended up with my cousin. I was like, oh, I just want to film like a little video, just a silly little video. And it was me going around saying that, you know, I didn't get paid for the AFL grand final, but it's changed my life. And it was me pretending that I was getting stuff for free and, you know, paying, not having to pay my rent because, you know, and yeah, it was really silly. It was filmed like in an afternoon in Perth, me driving around, like taking the absolute piss. And then it woke up, put it online, woke up the next morning and it had gone viral. And it was crazy. From that, things started to snowball. And yeah, it was crazy. I went on the Today Show, like Karl Stefanovic was like flirting with me. It wasn't, I'm just kidding. But also you can see for yourself in the video. But no, it was.
I'll link it in the programs page.
But no, it was just, it was crazy because also with a lot of that came a lot of like hate as well. Like I had Ricky Nixon, I sort of mentioned him in the video. Sort of all I said was, oh, you know, I didn't get paid, but Ricky Nixon asked for my number. I think he wants to represent me. And I remember my cousin gave me that little tip because I forgot who Ricky Nixon was, but the guy that I used to date played for St. Kilda, so I knew of him. And then in the interview, Carl asked me, have you heard from Ricky Nixon? And I made a little quip where I was like, oh, no, I haven't heard from him. Maybe I'm too old for him. And then he got tagged. Someone tagged him, and then he basically called me a fat, ugly slut.
What?
In a comment back to my friend when she tagged him in the video. that when she reposted the video of the interview and then he commented fat ugly slut, then that got picked up. I posted that that he did it. Clementine Ford shared it. Then the Daily Mail wrote an article about me and they called me like Australia's first attractive comedian. And it was all very flattering to me. Mm. Like the photos were great of me and they sort of were saying, you know, Ricky Nixon's come under fire again. And it was the best pub. Like I was going to say, he is a really good agent. He got me the best publicity that I've ever had.
Yeah.
it was crazy. It was insane. But it was also like, honestly, Mia, it was like being on a roller coaster and my adrenaline was so high, but my anxiety was so high. And yeah. I've never, that's the first time as well. Like I said, I had people seeing my bio and not understanding the joke or seeing my stand-up. I had other comedians message me, mostly women, who told me that I should take it out of my bio or I shouldn't, them not understanding what I was doing with that bio. It's crazy that it's all mostly through Instagram because of the pandemic, but it's,
I want to get back into that now because you have, you know, had that AFL video go viral and many videos since then on Instagram. Now that we're reaching some level of normality in the pandemic again and you have this big online presence.
Yeah.
How does that translate back to doing live shows and kind of entering the stage again?
Totally. So I feel like it's been a challenge, but I think as well for me, I have this like weird guilt of like, oh, I've got to make sure I'm posting more, but I haven't had much time. And it's sort of stressful when you're, you know, you feel like people have like been online, you know, watching you and stuff, and then you're not giving them that anymore because you're busy. But then I kind of try to give this sort of ultimatum of like, well, please come and pay to see me. Like, you know, if you enjoyed what you saw me do during lockdown when, you know, I wasn't making any money or wasn't working, please come and support me if you can. You know what I mean? Because that means so much. And it's definitely what's been so lovely after just finishing the comedy festival tour that we did with Mystery Flight and going to Melbourne Comedy Festival, then Perth, then back to Sydney. It's amazing how many people came to see Mystery Flight like a few times and, you know, like, yeah, seeing the show more than once was so lovely. And then also to see these fans after the shows that, you know, love what myself or Ruby do or our friends in the show. And yeah, it's beautiful. It's
a beautiful thing. Like
the
takeaway from this is, you know, keep watching Eloise on Instagram.
Oh, but thank you.
Also keep an eye out for the live shows.
Totally. I'm really hoping that I can get a solo show out very soon. I would love to be able to have that debut at Melbourne next year. But if I can do it in Sydney as like a little trial before that would be great. I'm going to take a little break after the Comedy Festival tour. I feel like a little bit burnt out, but I'll be doing a few spots here and there. And if there's anything coming up, please follow me on Instagram and Twitter, but mostly Instagram. I'll definitely post any updates on what I've got coming up. So, yeah.
Amazing. I'll put all the links to those ones up on the programs page on fbiradio.com.
Thank
so we
you,
can
Mia.
Keep an
Thank
eye
you.
Out.
Gosh, you're great. You can be my manager, actually.
Me and Ricky Nixon.
Yeah, yeah. Is that
bring all the publicity for you?
Yeah, thank you.
That's okay.
You're much nicer and better looking than him, so that's nice.
Thank you. What a beautiful note to end on.
Yes,
You have chosen a song called Young Hearts Run Free to wrap up the interview.
Yes. So this song, I ended up like, when I was back at high school, I was arts captain. We have a day called Arts Day. It was actually on my birthday the year that I was arts captain, and I performed this song as like the opening number, and it ended up, now I'm pretty sure they still do it at PLC at my high school in Perth, but it became like a little tradition that, you know, the arts captain does a performance. And even for me, like thinking about a solo show, I'm always like, maybe I'll end on this song, but also this song just makes me so happy and excited, and I just love to sing and dance to it. It's the Kim Maisel version, but and I think it should brighten up your day. And yeah, it's obviously from a very classic movie by an amazing Australian director as well. So yeah all of that.
Amazing. Well, I'll jump into that one right now. Eloise Eftos, thank you so much for joining me on Out of the Box. It's so lovely to meet you.
So lovely to meet you too, Mia. Thank you so much for having me and letting me ramble on. Good luck trying to get this into an hour.
Oh, look, I'll try my best. And we'll jump into the song. It's by Kim Maisel. It's called Young Hearts Run Free on FBI Radio 94.5. Hey, thank you so much for tuning in. If you did want to listen back to this episode, you can do that on the programs page on fbiradio.com, where you'll also find the full list of songs that Eloise brought to the show and some links to follow her and keep up to date with the things that she's doing. You can also listen back by the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give a big shout out to producer Tash for doing all of the research for this episode, and do stay tuned. Lunch is right around the corner. FBI.